on the wall could protect one from not only bugs, but disease and ill fortune as well. Otsu wrote the same verse scores of times, so often, in fact, that her wrists started to throb and her calligraphy began to reflect her fatigue. Stopping to rest for a moment, she called out to Takuang, "Stop trying to rob these people. You're taking too much."
"I'm talking to those who already have too much. It's become a burden. It's the essence of charity to relieve them of it," he replied.
"By that reasoning, common burglars are all holy men." Takuang was too busy collecting offerings to reply.
"Hear, hear," he said to the jostling crowd. "Don't push. Take your time. Just get in line. You'll have your chance to lighten your purses soon enough."
"Hey, priest,"
said a young man who'd been admonished for elbowing in.
"You mean me?"
Takuang said, pointing to his nose.
"Yeah. You keep telling us to wait our turn, but then you serve the women first."
"I like women as much as the next man."
"You must be one of those lecherous monks we're always hearing stories about."
"That's enough, you tadpole. Do you think I don't know why you're here? You didn't come to honor the Buddha or to take home a charm. You came to get a good look at Otsu. Come on now, own up. Isn't that so? You won't get anywhere with women, you know, if you act like a miser."
Otsu's face turned scarlet. "Takuan, stop it. Stop right now, or I'm really going to get mad." To rest her eyes, Otsu again looked up from her work and out over the crowd. Suddenly, she caught a glimpse of a face and dropped her brush with a clatter. She jumped to her feet, almost toppling the table, but the face had already vanished, like a fish disappearing in the sea. Oblivious of all around her, she dashed to the temple porch, shouting, "Takezo! Takezo!" The Dowager's Wrath. Matahachi's family, the Hong Iden, were the proud members of a group of rural gentry who belonged to the samurai class but who also worked the land. The real head of the family was his mother, an incorrigibly stubborn woman named Osugi. Though nearly 60, she led her family and tenants out to the fields daily and worked as hard as any of them. At planting time, she hoed the fields and, after the harvest, threshed the barley by trampling it. When dusk forced her to stop working, she always found something to sling on her bent back and haul back to the house. Often it was a load of mulberry leaves so big that her body, almost doubled over, was barely visible beneath it. In the evening, she could usually be found tending her silkworms. On the afternoon of the flower festival, Osugi looked up from her work in the mulberry patch to see her runny-nosed grandson racing barefoot across the field.
"Where have you been, Heita?"
she asked sharply.
"At the temple?"
"Uh-huh."
"Was Otsu there?"
"Yes," he answered excitedly, still out of breath. "And she had on a very pretty obi. She was helping with the festival."
"Did you bring back some sweet tea and a spell to keep the bugs away?"
"Uh-uh." The old woman's eyes, usually hidden amid folds and wrinkles, opened wide in irritation.
"And why not?"
"Otsu told me not to worry about them. She said I should run right home and tell you."
"Tell me what?"
"Takezo, from across the river. She said she saw him at the festival." Osugi's voice dropped an octave.
"Really? Did she really say that, Heita?"
"Yes, Granny." Her strong body seemed to go limp all at once, and her eyes blurred with tears. Slowly she turned, as though expecting to see her son standing behind her. Seeing no one, she spun back around.
"Heita,"
she said abruptly,
"you take over and pick these mulberry leaves."
"Where are you going?"
"Home. If Takezo's back, Matahachi must be too."
"I'll come too."
"No, you won't. Don't be a nuisance, Heita."
The old woman stalked off, leaving the little boy as forlorn as an orphan. The farmhouse, surrounded by old, gnarled oaks, was a large one. Osugi ran past it, heading straight for the barn where her daughter and some tenant farmers were working. While still a fair distance away, she began calling to them somewhat hysterically.
Has Matahachi come home? Is he here yet?
Startled, they stared at her as though she'd lost her wits. Finally, one of the men said, "No," but the old woman seemed not to hear. It was as though, in her overwrought state, she refused to take no for an answer. When they continued their non-committal gaze, she began calling them all dunces and explaining what she'd heard from Heita, how, if Takezo was back, then Matahachi must be too. Then, reassuming her role as commander-in-chief, she sent them off in all directions to find him. She herself stayed behind in the house, and every time she sensed someone approaching, ran out to ask if they had found her son yet. At sunset, still undaunted, she placed a candle before the memorial tablets of her husband's ancestors. She sat down, seemingly lost in prayer, as immobile as a statue. Since everyone was still out searching, there was no evening meal at the house, and when night fell and there was still no news, Osugi finally moved. As if in a trance, she walked slowly out of the house to the front gate. There she stood and waited, hidden in the darkness. A watery moon shone through the oak tree branches, and the mountains looming before and behind the house were veiled in a white mist. The Swedish scent of pear blossoms floated in the air. Time, too, floated by unnoticed. Then a figure could be discerned approaching, making its way along the outer edge of the pear orchard. Recognizing the silhouette as Otsu's, Osugi called out and the girl ran forward, her wet sandals clomping heavily on the earth.
"Otsu, they told me you saw Takezo. Is that true?"
"Yes, I'm sure it was him. I spotted him in the crowd outside the temple."
"You didn't see Matahachi?"
"No. I rushed out to ask Takezo about him, but when I called out, Takezo jumped like a scared rabbit. I caught his eye for a second, and then he was gone. He's always been strange, but I can't imagine why he ran away like that."
"Ran away?" asked Osugi with a puzzled air.
She began to muse, and the longer she did so, the more a terrible suspicion took shape in her mind. It was becoming clear to her that the Shinmen boy, that ruffian Takezo she so hated for luring her precious Matahachi off to war, was once more up to no good. At length, she said ominously,
"That wretch! He's probably left poor Matahachi to die somewhere, then sneaked back home safe and sound. Coward, that's what he is."
Osugi began to shake in fury and her voice rose to a shriek.
"He can't hide from me."
Otsu remained composed.
"Oh, I don't think he'd do anything like that. Even if he did have to leave Matahachi behind, surely he'd bring us word, or at least some keepsake from him."
Otsu sounded shocked by the old woman's hasty accusation.
Osugi, however, was by now convinced of Takezo's perfidy. She shook her head decisively and went on.
"Oh, no, he wouldn't. Not that young demon. He hasn't got that much heart. Matahachi should never have taken up with him."
"Granny," Otsu said soothingly.
"What?"
snapped Osugi, not soothed in the least.
"I think that if we go over to Ogin's house, we just might find Takezo there."
The old woman relaxed a bit.
"You might be right. She is his sister, and there really isn't anyone else in this village who'd take him in."
"Then let's go and see, just the two of us."
Osugi balked.
"I don't see why I should do that. She knew her brother had dragged my son off to war, but she never once came to apologize or to pay her respects. And now that he's back, she hasn't even come to tell me. I don't see why I should go to her. It's demeaning. I'll wait here for her."
"But this isn't an ordinary situation," replied Otsu. "Besides, the main thing at this point is to see Takezo as soon as we can. We've got to find out what happened." "Oh, please, Granny, come. You won't have to do anything. I'll take care of all the formalities if you like."
Grudgingly, Osugi allowed herself to be persuaded. She was, of course, as eager as Otsu to find out what was going on, but she died before begging for anything from a shinmen. The house was about a mile away. Like the Hongiden family, the shinmen were country gentry, and both houses were descended from the Akamatsu clan many generations back. Situated across the river from one another, they had always tacitly recognized each other's right to exist, but that was the extent of their intimacy. When they arrived at the front gate, they found it shut, and the trees were so thick that no light could be seen from the house. Otsu started to walk around to the back entrance, but Osugi stopped mulishly in her tracks.
"I don't think it's right for the head of the Hongiden family to enter the Shinmen residence by the back door. It's degrading."
Seeing she wasn't going to budge, Otsu proceeded to the rear entrance alone. Presently, a light appeared just inside the gate. Ogin herself had come out to greet the older woman, who suddenly transformed from a crone plowing the fields into a great lady, addressed her hostess in lofty tones.
"Forgive me for disturbing you at this late hour, but my business simply could not wait. How good of you to come and let me in."
Sweeping past Ogin and on into the house, she went immediately, as though she were an envoy from the gods, to the most honored spot in the room, in front of the alcove. Sitting proudly, her figure framed by both a hanging scroll and a flower arrangement, she deigned to accept Ogin's sincerest words of welcome. The amenities concluded, Osugi went straight to the point. Her false smile disappeared as she glared at the young woman before her.
"I have been told that young demon of this house has crawled back home. Please fetch him."
Although Osugi's tongue was notorious for its sharpness, this undisguised maliciousness came as something of a shock to the gentle Ogin.
"Whom do you mean by that young demon?" asked Ogin with palpable restraint.
Chameleon-like, Osugi changed her tactics.
"A slip of the tongue, I assure you," she said with a laugh. "That's what the people in the village call him. I suppose I picked it up from them. The young demon is Takezo. He is hiding here, isn't he?"
"Why, no," replied Ogin with genuine astonishment.
Embarrassed to hear her brother referred to in this way, she bit her lip. Otsu, taking pity on her, explained that she had spotted Takezo at the festival. Then, in an attempt to smooth over ruffled feelings, she added,
"Strange, isn't it, that he didn't come straight here?"
"Well, he didn't," said Ogin. "This is the first I've heard anything about it. But if he is back, as you say, I'm sure he'll be knocking at the door any minute." Osugi, sitting formally on the floor cushion, legs tucked neatly beneath her, folded her hands in her lap and, with the expression of an outraged mother-in-law, launched into a tirade.
"What is all this? Do you expect me to believe you haven't heard from him yet? Don't you understand that I'm the mother whose son your young ne'er-do-well dragged off to war? Don't you know that Matahachi is the heir and the most important member of the Hongiden family? It was your brother who talked my boy into going off to get himself killed. If my son is dead, it's your brother who killed him. And if he thinks he can just sneak back alone and get away with it..."
The old woman stopped just long enough to catch her breath. Then her eyes glared in fury once more.
"And what about you? Since he's obviously had the indecency to sneak back by himself, why haven't you, his older sister, sent him immediately to me? I'm disgusted with both of you, treating an old woman with such disrespect. Who do you think I am?"
Gulping down another breath, she ranted on.
"If your Takezo is back, then bring my Matahachi back to me. If you can't do that, the least you can do is set that young demon down right here and make him explain to my satisfaction what happened to my precious boy and where he is, right now."
"How can I do that? He isn't here."
"That's a black lie!"
she shrieked. You must know where he is!
But I tell you, I don't, Ogim protested. Her voice quivered and her eyes filled with tears. She bent over, wishing with all her might her father were still alive. Suddenly, from the door opening onto the veranda came a cracking noise, followed by the sound of running feet. Osugi's eyes flashed, and Otsu started to stand up, but the next sound was a hair-raising scream, as close to an animal's howl as the human voice is capable of producing. A man shouted, "Catch him!" Then came the sound of more feet, several more, running around the house, accompanied by the snapping of twigs and the rustling of bamboo.
"It's Takezo!"
cried Osugi. Jumping to her feet, she glared at the kneeling Ogin and spat out her words.
I knew he was here, she said ferociously. It was as clear to me as the nose on your face. I don't know why you've tried to hide him from me, but bear in mind, I'll never forget this.
She rushed to the door and slid it open with a bang. What she saw outside turned her already pale face even whiter. A young man wearing shin plates was lying face up on the ground, obviously dead, but with fresh blood still streaming from his eyes and nose. Judging from the appearance of his shattered skull, someone had killed him with a single blow of a wooden sword.
There's a dead man out there, she stammered.
Otsu brought the light to the veranda and stood beside Osugi, who was staring terror-stricken at the corpse. It was neither Takezo's nor Matahachi's, but that of a samurai neither of them recognized. Osugi murmured,
Who could have done this?
Turning swiftly to Otsu, she said,
Let's go home before we get mixed up in something.
Otsu couldn't bring herself to leave. The old woman had said a lot of vicious things. It would be unfair to Ogin to leave before putting salve on the wounds. If Ogin had been lying, Otsu felt she must doubtless have had good reason. Feeling she should stay behind to comfort Ogin, she told Osugi she would be along later.
Do as you please,
snapped Osugi, as she made her departure. Ogin graciously offered her a lantern, but Osugi was proudly defiant in her refusal.
I'll have you know that the head of the Hon-Iden family is not so senile that she needs a light to walk by.
She tucked up her kimono hems, left the house, and walked resolutely into the thickening mist. Not far from the house, a man called her to a halt. He had his sword drawn, and his arms and legs were protected by armor. He was obviously a professional samurai of a type not ordinarily encountered in the village.
"Didn't you just come from the Shinmen house?" he asked.
"Yes, but..."
"Are you a member of the Shinmen household?"
"Certainly not,"
Osugi snapped, waving her hand in protest.
"I am the head of the samurai house across the river."
"Does that mean you are the mother of Hon-Iden Matahachi, who went with Shinmen Takezo to the Battle of Sekigahara?"
"Well, yes, but my son didn't go because he wanted to. He was tricked into going by that young demon."
"Demon?"
"That Takezo."
"I gather this Takezo is not too well thought of in the village."
"Well thought of? That's a laugh. You never saw such a hoodlum. You can't imagine the trouble we've had at my house since my son took up with him."
"Your son seems to have died at Sekigahara. I'm..."
"Matahachi? Dead?"
"Well, actually, I'm not sure, but perhaps it'll be some comfort to you in your grief to know that I'll do everything possible to help you take revenge."
Osugi eyed him skeptically.
"Just who are you?"
"I'm with the Tokugawa garrison. We came to Himeji Castle after the battle. On orders from my lord, I've set up a barrier on the Harima province border to screen everyone who crosses. This Takezo from that house back there," he continued, pointing, "broke through the barrier and fled toward Miyamoto. We chased him all the way here. He's a tough one, all right. We thought that after a few days of walking he'd collapse, but we still haven't caught up with him. He can't go on forever, though. We'll get him."
Nodding as she listened, Osugi realized now why Takezo hadn't appeared at the Shippoji, and more importantly, that he probably hadn't gone home, since that was the first place the soldiers would search. At the same time, since it seemed he was traveling alone, her fury wasn't diminished in the least. But as for Matahachi being dead, she couldn't believe that either.
"I know Takezo can be as strong and cunning as any wild beast, sir," she said coyly. "But I shouldn't think that samurai of your caliber would have any trouble capturing him."
"Well, frankly, that's what I thought at first. But there aren't many of us, and he's just killed one of my men."
"Let an old woman give you a few words of advice."
Leaning over, she whispered something in his ear. Her words seemed to please him immensely. He nodded his approval and enthusiastically exclaimed,
"Good idea. Splendid." "Be sure to do a thorough job of it," urged Osugi as she took her leave.
Not long afterward, the samurai regrouped his band of 14 or 15 men behind Ogin's house. After he briefed them, they piled over the wall, surrounding the house and blocking all exits. Several soldiers then stormed into the house, leaving a trail of mud, and crowded into the inner room where the two young women sat commiserating and dabbing at their tear-stained faces. Confronted by the soldiers, Otsu gasped and turned white. Ogin, however, proud to be the daughter of Munisai, was unperturbed. With calm, steely eyes, she stared indignantly at the intruders.
"Which one of you is Takezo's sister?"
asked one of them.
"I am," replied Ogin coldly. "And I demand to know why you've entered this house without permission. I will not stand for such brutish behavior in a house occupied only by women."
She had turned to face them directly. The man, who had been chatting with Osugi a few minutes earlier, pointed to Ogin.
"Arrest her!"
he ordered. Barely were the words out of his mouth before violence erupted. The house began to shake and the lights went out. Uttering a cry of terror, Otsu stumbled out into the garden, while at least 10 of the soldiers fell upon Ogin and began tying her up with a rope. Despite her heroic resistance, it was all over in a few seconds. They then pushed her down onto the floor and began kicking her as hard as they could. Otsu couldn't recall afterward which way she had come, but somehow she managed to escape. Barely conscious, she ran barefoot toward the Shippoji in the misty moonlight, relying completely on instinct. She had grown up in peaceful surroundings and now felt as though the world were caving in. When she reached the foot of the hill where the temple stood, someone called to her. She saw a shape sitting on a rock among the trees. It was Takuan.
"Thank heaven it's you," he said. "I was really starting to worry. You never stay out this late. When I realized the time, I came out looking for you."
He looked down toward the ground and asked,
"Why are you barefoot?"
He was still gazing at Otsu's bare white feet when she rushed headlong into his arms and began wailing.
"Oh, Takuan, it was awful. What can we do?"
In a calm voice, he tried to soothe her.
"There, there. What was awful? There aren't many things in this world that are all that bad. Calm down and tell me what happened."
"They tied Ogin up and took her away. Matahachi didn't come back, and now poor Ogin, who's so sweet and gentle, they were all kicking her. Oh, Takuan, we've got to do something."
Sobbing and trembling, she clung desperately to the young monk, her head resting on his chest. It was noon on a still, humid spring day, and a faint mist rose from the young man's sweating face. Takezo was walking alone in the mountains, whither he knew not. He was tired, almost beyond endurance, but even at the sound of a bird alighting, his eyes would dart around. Despite the ordeal he'd been through, his mud-spattered body came alive with pent-up violence and the sheer instinct to survive.
"Bastards! Beasts!" he growled.
In the absence of the real target of his fury, he swung his black oak sword screeching through the air, slicing a thick branch off a large tree. The white sap that poured from the wound reminded him of a nursing mother's milk. He stood and stared. With no mother to turn to, there was only loneliness.
Instead of offering him comfort, even the running streams and rolling hills of his own home seemed to mock him. "Why are all the villagers against me?" he wondered. "The minute they see me, they report me to the guards on the mountain. The way they run when they catch sight of me, you'd think I was a madman." He'd been hiding in the Sanumo Mountains for 4 days. Now, through the veil of the midday mist, he could make out the house of his father, the house where his sister lived alone. Nestled in the foothills just below him was the Shippoji, the temple's roof jutting out from the trees. He knew he could approach neither place. When he dared go near the temple on the Buddha's birthday, crowded though it was, he'd risked his life. When he heard his name called, he had no choice but to flee. Aside from wanting to save his own neck, he knew that being discovered there would mean trouble for Otsu. That night, when he'd gone stealthily to his sister's house, Matahachi's mother, as luck would have it, had been there. For a while, he'd just stood outside, trying to come up with an explanation of Matahachi's whereabouts, but as he was watching his sister through a crack in the door, the soldiers had spotted him. Again, he had to flee without having the chance to speak to anyone. Since then, it appeared from his refuge in the mountains that the Tokugawa samurai were keeping a very sharp eye out for him. They patrolled every road he might take, while at the same time the villagers had banded together to form search parties and were scouring the mountains. He wondered what Otsu must think of him and began to suspect that even she had turned against him. Since it appeared that everyone in his own village regarded him as an enemy, he was stymied. He thought, it'd be too hard to tell Otsu the real reason her fiancé didn't come back. Maybe I should tell the old woman instead. That's it. If I explain everything to her, she can break it gently to Otsu. Then there wouldn't be any reason for me to hang around here. His mind made up, Takezo resumed walking, but he knew that it would not do to go near the village before dark. With a large rock, he broke another into small pieces and hurled one of them at a bird in flight. After it fell to earth, he barely paused to pluck its feathers before sinking his half-starved teeth into the warm, raw flesh. As he was devouring the bird, he started walking again, but suddenly heard a stifled cry. Whoever had caught sight of him was scrambling away frantically through the woods, angered at the idea of being hated and feared, persecuted for no reason. He shouted, "Wait!" and began running like a panther after the fleeing form. The man was no match for Takezo and was easily overtaken. It turned out to be one of the villagers who came to the mountains to make charcoal, and Takezo knew him by sight. Grabbing his collar, he dragged him back to a small clearing. "Why are you running away? Don't you know me? I'm one of you, Shinmen Takezo of Miyamoto. I'm not going to eat you alive. You know, it's very rude to run away from people without even saying hello."
Yes, sir.
Sit down." Takezo released his grip on the man's arm, but the pitiful creature started to flee, forcing Takezo to kick his behind and make as if to strike him with his wooden sword. The man cringed on the ground like a simpering dog, his hands over his head.
"Don't kill me!"
he screamed pathetically. "Just answer my questions, all right?"
"I'll tell you anything. Just don't kill me. I have a wife and family."
"Nobody's going to kill you. I suppose the hills are crawling with soldiers, aren't they?"
"Yes."
"Are they keeping close watch on the Shippoji?"
"Yes."
"Are the men from the village hunting for me again today?" Silence. "Are you one of them?" The man jumped to his feet, shaking his head like a deaf mute.
"No, no, no!"
"That's enough," shouted Takezo. Taking a firm grip on the man's neck, he asked, "What about my sister?"
"What sister?"
"My sister, Ogin, of the House of Shinmen. Don't play dumb. You promised to answer my questions. I don't really blame the villagers for trying to capture me, because the samurai are forcing them to do it, but I'm sure they'd never do anything to hurt her. Or would they?" The man replied, too innocently,
"I don't know anything about that. Nothing at all."
Takezo swiftly raised his sword above his head in position to strike. "Watch it. That sounded very suspicious to me. Something has happened, hasn't it? Out with it, or I'll smash your skull."
Wait, don't! I'll talk! I'll tell you everything!
Hands folded in supplication, the trembling charcoal maker told how Ogin had been taken away a prisoner, and how an order had been circulated in the village to the effect that anyone providing Takezo with food or shelter would automatically be regarded as an accomplice. Each day, he reported, the soldiers were leading villagers into the mountains, and each family was required to furnish one young man every other day for this purpose. The information caused Takezo to break out in goose pimples. Not fear. Rage. To make sure he'd heard right, he asked, "What crime has my sister been charged with?" His eyes were glistening with moisture.
"None of us knows anything about it. We're afraid of the district lord. We're just doing what we're told, that's all."
"Where have they taken my sister?"
"Rumor has it that they've got her in Hinagura stockade, but I don't know if that's true."
"Hinagura," repeated Takezo.
His eyes turned toward the ridge that marked the provincial border. The backbone of the mountains was already spotted with the shadows of gray evening clouds. Takezo let the man go. Watching him scramble away, grateful to have his meager life spared, made Takezo's stomach turn at the thought of the cowardice of humanity, the cowardice that forced samurai to pick on a poor, helpless woman. He was glad to be alone again. He had to think. He soon reached the decision. "I have to rescue Ogin, and that's that. My poor sister. I'll kill them all if they've harmed her." Having chosen his course of action, he marched down toward the village with long, manly strides. A couple of hours later, Takezo again furtively approached the Shippoji. The evening bell had just stopped tolling. It was already dark, and lights could be seen coming from the temple itself, the kitchen and the priest's quarters, where people seemed to be moving about. "If only Otsu would come out," he thought. He crouched motionless under the raised passageway. It was of the sort that had a roof but no walls, which connected the priest's rooms with the main temples. The smell of food being cooked floated in the air, conjuring up visions of rice and steaming soup. For the past few days, Takezo had had nothing in his stomach but raw bird meat and grass shoots, and his stomach now rebelled. His throat burned as he vomited up bitter gastric juices, and in his misery he gasped loudly for breath.
"What was that?" said a voice.
"Probably just a cat," answered Otsu, who came out carrying a dinner tray and started crossing the passageway directly over Takezo's head.
He tried to call to her, but was still too nauseated to make an intelligible sound. This, as it happened, was a stroke of luck, because just then a male voice just behind Otsu inquired,
"Which way is the bath?"
The man was wearing a kimono borrowed from the temple, tied with a narrow sash from which dangled a small washcloth. Takezo recognized him as one of the samurai from Himeji. Evidently, he was of high rank, high enough to lodge at the temple and pass his evenings eating and drinking his fill, while his subordinates and the villagers had to scour mountainsides day and night searching for the fugitive.
"The bath?" said Otsu. "Come, I'll show you."
She set her tray down and began leading him along the passageway. Suddenly, the samurai rushed forward and hugged her from behind.
"How about joining me in the bath?" he suggested lecherously.
"Stop that! Let go of me!" cried Otsu,
but the man, turning her around, held her face in both big hands and brushed his lips against her cheek.
"What's wrong?" he cajoled. "Don't you like men?"
"Stop it! You shouldn't do that!"
protested the helpless Otsu. The soldier then clapped his hand over her mouth. Takezo, oblivious of the danger, leapt up onto the passageway like a cat and thrust his fist at the man's head from behind. The blow was a hard one. Momentarily defenseless, the samurai fell backward, still clinging to Otsu. As she tried to break away from his hold, she let out a shrill scream. The fallen man began shouting,
"It's him! It's Takezo! He's here! Come and take him!"
The rumble of feet and the roar of voices thundered from inside the temple. The temple bell began signaling the alarm that Takezo had been discovered. And from the woods, throngs of men began converging on the temple grounds. But Takezo was already gone, and before long search parties were once again sent out to scour the hills of Sanumo. Takezo himself hardly knew how he'd slipped through the swiftly tightening net, but by the time the chase was in full swing, he found himself standing far away at the entrance to the large, dirt-floored kitchen of the Hongiden house. Looking into the dimly lit interior, he called out, "Granny!"
"Who's there?"
came the shrill reply. Osugi ambled out from a back room. Lit from below by the paper lantern in her hand, her gnarled face paled at the sight of her visitor.
"You!"
she cried. "I have something important to tell you," Takezo said hurriedly. "Matahachi isn't dead. He's still very much alive and healthy. He's staying with a woman in another province. That's all I can tell you, because that's all I know. Will you please somehow break the news to Otsu for me? I couldn't do it myself." Immensely relieved to have unburdened himself of the message, he started to leave, but the old woman called him back.
"Where do you plan to go from here?"
"I have to break into the stockade at Hinagura and rescue Ogin," he replied sadly. "After that, I'll go away somewhere. I just wanted to tell you and your family, as well as Otsu, that I didn't let Matahachi die. Other than that, I have no reason to be here."
"I see."
Osugi shifted the lantern from one hand to the other, playing for time. Then she beckoned to him.
"I'll bet you're hungry, aren't you?"
"I haven't had a decent meal for days."
"You poor boy. Wait, I'm in the middle of cooking right now, and I can give you a nice warm dinner in no time, as a going-away present. And wouldn't you like to take a bath while I'm getting it ready?"
Takezo was speechless.
"Don't look so shocked. Takezo, your family and ours have been together since the days of the Akamatsu clan. I don't think you should leave here at all, but I certainly won't let you go without giving you a good hearty meal."
Again, Takezo was unable to reply. He raised his arm and wiped his eyes. No one had been this kind to him for a long, long time. Having come to regard everybody with suspicion and distrust, he was suddenly remembering what it was like to be treated as a human being.
"Hurry on round to the bathhouse now," urged Osugi in grandmotherly tones. "It's too dangerous to stand here. Someone might see you. I'll bring you a washcloth, and while you're washing, I'll get out Matahachi's kimono and some underwear for you. Now take your time and have a good soak."
She handed him the lantern and disappeared into the back of the house. Almost immediately, her daughter-in-law left the house, ran through the garden, and off into the night. From the bathhouse, where the lantern swung back and forth, came the sound of splashing water.
"How is it?" Osugi called jovially. "Hot enough?"
"It's just right. I feel like a new man," Takezo called back.
"Take your time and get good and warm. The rice isn't ready yet."
"Thanks. If I'd known it'd be like this, I'd have come sooner. I was sure you'd have it in for me." He spoke two or three more times, but his voice was drowned out by the sound of the water, and Osugi didn't answer. Before long, the daughter-in-law reappeared at the gate, all out of breath. She was followed by a band of samurai and vigilantes. Osugi came out of the house and addressed them in a whisper.
"Ah, you got him to take a bath. Very clever," said one of the men admiringly. "Yes, that's fine. We've got him for sure this time."
Splitting into two groups, the men crouched and moved cautiously, like so many toads, toward the fire blazing brightly under the bath. Something indefinable, pricked Takezo's instincts, and he peeped out through a crack in the door. His hair stood on end.
"I've been trapped!"
he screamed. He was stark naked. The bathhouse was tiny, and there was no time to think. Beyond the door, he'd spotted what seemed like hordes of men armed with staffs, lances, and truncheons. Still, he wasn't really afraid. Any fear he might have had was blotted out by his anger toward Osugi.
"All right, you bastards, watch this,"
he growled. He was well beyond caring how many of them there were. In this situation, as in others, the only thing he knew how to do was to attack rather than be attacked. As his would-be captors made way for each other outside, he abruptly kicked open the door and jumped out and into the air, bellowing a fearsome war whoop. Still naked, his wet hair flying in every direction, he seized and wrenched loose the shaft of the first lance thrust at him, sending its owner flying into the bushes. Taking a firm grip on the weapon, he thrashed about like a whirling dervish, swinging with complete abandon and hitting anyone who came near. He'd learned at Sekigahara that this method was startlingly effective when a man was outnumbered, and that the shaft of a lance could often be used more tellingly than the blade. The attackers, realizing too late what a blunder they'd made by not sending three or four men charging into the bathhouse in the first place, shouted encouragement to one another. It was clear, however, they'd been outmaneuvered. About the 10th time Takezo's weapon came in contact with the ground, it broke. He then seized a large rock and threw it at the men, who were already showing signs of backing down. "Look, he's run inside the house!" shouted one of them, as simultaneously Osugi and her daughter-in-law scrambled out into the back garden. Making a tremendous clatter as he stormed through the house, Takezo was yelling, "Where are my clothes? Give me back my clothes!" There were work clothes lying about, not to speak of an elaborate kimono chest, but Takezo paid them no attention. He was straining his eyes in the dim light to find his own ragged garment. Finally spotting it in the corner of the kitchen, he seized it in one hand and, finding a foothold atop a large earthenware oven, crawled out of a small high window. While he made his way onto the roof, his pursuers, now totally confused, cursed and made excuses to each other for their failure to ensnare him. Standing in the middle of the roof, Takezo unhurriedly donned his kimono. With his teeth, he tore off a strip of cloth from his sash and, gathering his damp hair behind, tied it near the roots so tightly that his eyebrows and the corners of his eyes were stretched. The spring sky was full of stars. The Art of War. The daily search in the mountains continued, and farm work languished. The villagers could neither cultivate their fields nor tend to their silkworms. Large signs posted in front of the village headman's house and at every crossroads announced a substantial reward for anyone who captured or killed Takezo, as well as suitable recompense for any information leading to his arrest. The notices bore the authoritative signature of Ikeda Terumasa, Lord of Himeji Castle. At the Hongiden residence, panic prevailed. Osugi and her family, trembling in mortal dread lest Takezo come to take his revenge, bolted the main gate and barricaded all entrances. The searchers, under the direction of troops from Himeji, laid fresh plans to trap the fugitive. Thus far, all their efforts had proved fruitless. "He's killed another one!" a villager shouted. "Where? Who was it this time?" "Some samurai. No one's identified him yet." The corpse had been discovered near a path on the village outskirts, its head in a clump of tall weeds and its legs raised skyward in a baffling, contorted position. Frightened but incurably nosy, villagers milled about, babbling among themselves. The skull had been smashed, evidently with one of the wooden reward signs, which now lay across the body soaked in blood. Those gawking at the spectacle could not avoid reading the list of promised rewards. Some laughed grimly at the blatant irony. Otsu's face was drawn and pale as she emerged from the crowd. Wishing she hadn't looked, she hurried toward the temple, trying to somehow blot out the image of the dead man's face lingering before her eyes. At the foot of the hill, she ran into the captain who was lodging at the temple and five or six of his men. They had heard of the gruesome killing and were on their way to investigate. Upon seeing the girl, the captain grinned. "Where have you been, Otsu?" he said with ingratiating familiarity. "Shopping," she replied curtly. Without bestowing so much as a glance upon him, she hurried up the temple's stone steps. She hadn't liked the man to begin with.
He had a stringy mustache, which she took particular exception to, but since the night he'd tried to force himself on her, the sight of him filled her with loathing. Takuan was sitting in front of the main hall, playing with a stray dog. She was hurrying by at some distance to avoid the mangy animal when the monk looked up and called, "Otsu, there's a letter for you."
"For me?" she asked incredulously.
"Yes, you were out when the runner came, so he left it with me."
Taking the small scroll out of his kimono sleeve and handing it to her, he said,
"You don't look too good. Is something wrong?"
"I feel sick. I saw a dead man lying in the grass. His eyes were still open, and there was blood."
"You shouldn't look at things like that. But I guess the way things are now, you'd have to walk around with your eyes closed. I'm always tripping over corpses these days. Ha! And I'd heard this village was a little paradise."
"But why is Takezo killing all these people?"
"To keep them from killing him, of course. They don't have any real reason to kill him, so why should he let them?"
"Takuan, I'm scared," she said pleadingly. "What would we do if he came here?"
Dark cumulus clouds were drawing their cloak over the mountains. She took her mysterious letter and went to hide in the loom shed. On the loom was an unfinished strip of cloth for a man's kimono, part of the garment which, since the year before, she'd been spending every spare moment spinning silk yarn for. It was for Matahachi, and she was excited by the prospect of sewing all the pieces together into a full kimono. She had woven every strand meticulously, as if the weaving itself were drawing him closer to her. She wanted the garment to last forever. Seating herself before the loom, she gazed intently at the letter.
"Whoever could have sent it?"
she whispered to herself, sure that the letter must have really been meant for someone else. She read the address over and over, searching for a flaw. The letter had obviously made a long journey to reach her. The torn and crumpled wrapper was smudged all over with fingerprints and raindrops. She broke the seal, whereupon not one but two letters fell into her lap. The first was in an unfamiliar woman's hand, a somewhat older woman, she quickly guessed.
"I am writing merely to confirm what is written in the other letter, and will therefore not go into details. I am marrying Matahachi and adopting him into my family. However, he still seems concerned about you. I think it would be a mistake to let matters stand as they are. Matahachi is therefore sending you an explanation, the truth of which I hereby witness. Please forget Matahachi. Respectfully, Oko."
The other letter was in Matahachi's scrawl and explained at tiresome length all the reasons why it was impossible for him to return home. The gist of it, of course, was that Otsu should forget about her betrothal to him and find another husband. Matahachi added that since it was difficult for him to write directly to his mother of these matters, he would appreciate her help. If Otsu happened to see the old woman, she was to tell her Matahachi was alive and well and living in another province. Otsu felt the marrow of her spine turn to ice. She sat stricken, too shocked to cry or even to blink. The nails of the fingers holding the letter turned the same color as the skin of the dead man she had seen less than an hour before. The hours passed. Everyone in the kitchen began wondering where she'd gone. The captain in charge of the search was content to let his exhausted men sleep in the woods, but when he himself returned to the temple at dusk, he demanded comforts befitting his status. The bath had to be heated just so, fresh fish from the river had to be prepared to his specifications, and someone had to fetch sake of the highest quality from one of the village homes. A great deal of work was entailed in keeping the man happy, and much of it, naturally, fell to Otsu. Since she was nowhere to be found, the captain's dinner was late. Takuan went out to search for her. He had no concern whatsoever for the captain, but he was beginning to worry about Otsu herself. It just wasn't like her to go off without a word. Calling her name, the monk crossed the temple grounds, passing by the loom shed several times.
Since the door was shut, he didn't bother to look inside. Several times the temple priest stepped out into the raised passageway and shouted to Takuang,
"Have you found her yet? She's got to be around here somewhere."
As time went on, he grew frantic, calling out,
"Hurry up and find her! Our guest says he can't drink his sake without her here to pour it for him."
The temple's manservant was dispatched down the hill to search for her, lantern in hand. At almost the same moment he took off, Takuan finally opened the loom shed door. What he saw inside gave him a start. Otsu was drooped over the loom in a state of obvious desolation. Not wanting to pry, he remained silent, staring at the two twisted and torn letters on the ground. They had been trampled on like a couple of straw effigies. Takuan picked them up.
"Aren't these what the runner brought today?" he asked gently. "Why don't you put them away somewhere?"
Otsu shook her head feebly.
"Everyone's half crazy with worry about you. I've been looking all over. Come, Otsu, let's go back. I know you don't want to, but you really do have work to do. You've got to serve the captain, for one thing. That old priest is nearly beside himself."
My head hurts, she whispered. "Takuan, couldn't they let me off tonight? Just this once?"
Takuan sighed.
"Otsu, I personally think you shouldn't have to serve the captain's sake tonight or any night. The priest, however, is of a different mind. He is a man of this world. He's not the type who can gain the daimyo's respect or support for the temple through high-mindedness alone. He believes he has to wine and dine the captain, keep him happy every minute."
He patted Otsu on the back.
"And after all, he did take you in and raise you, so you do owe him something. You won't have to stay long."
She consented reluctantly. While Takuan was helping her up, she raised her tear-stained face to him and said,
"I'll go, but only if you promise to stay with me."
"I have no objection to that, but old Scraggly Beard doesn't like me, and every time I see that silly mustache, I have an irresistible urge to tell him how ridiculous it looks. It's childish, I know, but some people just affect me that way."
"But I don't want to go alone."
"The priest is there, isn't he?"
"Yes, but he always leaves when I arrive."
That's not so good. All right, I'll go with you. Now stop thinking about it and go wash your face."
When Otsu finally appeared at the priest's quarters, the captain, already slouching drunkenly, immediately perked up. Straightening his cap, which had been listing noticeably, he became quite jovial and called for refill after refill. Soon his face glowed scarlet and the corners of his bulging eyes began to sag. He was not enjoying himself to the full, however, and the reason was a singularly unwanted presence in the room. On the other side of the lamp sat Takuan, bent over like a blind beggar, absorbed in reading the book open on his knees. Mistaking the monk for an acolyte, the captain pointed at him, bellowing,
"Hey, you there!"
Takuan continued reading until Otsu gave him a nudge. He raised his eyes absently and, looking all around, said,
"You mean me?"
The captain spoke gruffly.
"Yes, you. I have no business with you. Leave." "Oh, I don't mind staying,"
Takuan replied innocently.
"Oh, you don't, do you?"
"No, not at all,"
Takuan said, returning to his book.
"Well, I mind," the captain blustered. "It spoils the taste of good sake to have someone around reading."
"Oh, I'm sorry,"
responded Takuan with mock solicitude.
"How rude of me. I'll just close the book."
"The very sight annoys me."
"All right, then. I'll have Otsu put it away."
"Not the book, you idiot. I'm talking about you. You spoil the setting."
Takuan's expression became grave.
"Now, that is a problem, isn't it? It's not as though I were the sacred Wu Kong and could change myself into a puff of smoke, or become an insect and perch on your tray."
The captain's red neck swelled and his eyes bulged. He looked like a blowfish.
Get out, you fool! Out of my sight!
Very well, said Takuang quietly, bowing.
Taking Otsu's hand, he addressed her.
The guest says he prefers to be alone. To love solitude is the mark of the sage. We mustn't bother him further. Come.
Why, you...
Is something wrong?
Who said anything about taking Otsu with you, you ugly moron?
Takuan folded his arms.
I've observed over the years that not many priests or monks are particularly handsome. Not many samurai either, for that matter. Take you, for example.
The captain's eyes nearly leapt from their sockets.
What?
Have you considered your mustache? I mean, have you ever really taken the time to look at it, to evaluate it objectively?
You crazy bastard!
Shouted the captain as he reached for his sword, which was leaning against the wall.
Watch yourself!
As he got to his feet, Takuan, keeping one eye on him, asked placidly,
How do I go about watching myself?
The captain, who was by now screaming, had his sheathed sword in the hand.
I've taken all I can take. Now you're going to get what's coming to you.
Takuan burst out laughing.
Does that mean you plan to cut off my head? If so, forget it. It would be a terrible bore.
Huh?
A bore? I can't think of anything more boring than cutting off a monk's head. It would just fall to the floor and lie there laughing up at you. Not a very grand accomplishment, and what good could it possibly do you?
Well, growled the captain, let's just say I'd have the satisfaction of shutting you up. It'll be pretty hard for you to keep up your insolent chatter.
Filled with the courage such people derive from having a weapon in hand, he laughed a mean belly laugh and moved forward threateningly.
But Captain!
Takuan's offhand manner had so enraged him that the hand in which he held his scabbard was shaking violently. Otsu slipped between the two men in an effort to protect Takuan.
What are you saying, Takuan?
She said, hoping to lighten the mood and slow the action.
People don't talk like that to warriors. Now, just say you're sorry, she entreated. Come on, apologize to the captain.
Takuan, however, was anything but finished.
Get out of the way, Otsu. I'm all right. Do you really think I'd let myself be beheaded by a dolt like this, who, though commanding scores of able, armed men, has wasted 20 days trying to locate one exhausted, half-starved fugitive? If he hasn't had enough sense to find Takezo, it would indeed be amazing if he could outwit me.
Don't move!
Commanded the captain. His bloated face turned purple as he moved to draw his sword.
Stand aside, Otsu! I'm going to cut this big-mouthed acolyte in two!
Otsu fell at the captain's feet and pleaded,
You have every reason to be angry, but please be patient. He's not quite right in the head. He talks to everybody this way. He doesn't mean anything by it, really!
Tears began gushing from her eyes.
What are you saying, Otsu?
Objected Takuan.
There's nothing wrong with my mind, and I'm not joking. I'm only telling the truth, which no one seems to like to hear. He's a dolt, so I called him a dolt. You want me to lie?
You'd better not say that again,
thundered the samurai.
I'll say it as often as I wish. By the way, I don't suppose it makes any difference to you soldiers how much time you squander looking for Takezo, but it's a terrible burden on the farmers. Do you realize what you're doing to them? They won't be able to eat soon if you keep this up. It probably hasn't even occurred to you that they have to neglect their field work completely to go out on your disorganized wild goose chases, and with no wages, I might add. It's a disgrace.
Hold your tongue, traitor! That's outright slander against the Tokugawa government.
It isn't the Tokugawa government I'm criticizing. It's bureaucratic officials like you who stand between the daimyo and the common people,
and who might as well be stealing their pay for all they do to earn it. For one thing, exactly why are you lounging around here tonight? What gives you the right to relax in your nice, comfortable kimono, all snug and warm, take leisurely baths and have